Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today it's Earth Day. Happy Earth Day, everyone. And every year for Earth Day, we have a great tradition going. We check in with writer and photographer Stephen Trimble, author of Bargaining for Eden, The Fight for the Last Open Spaces in America, and many other books. And in the past, we've focused on Bear's Ears and the Great Salt Lake, the transition to younger leaders in environmental justice, the 30 by 30 land preservation proposal, and many other topics over the 10 years or so we've been doing this. And in this election year, Stephen suggested, why don't we try to clearly lay out plans for the environment under either a reelected Biden administration or a second Trump administration. So that's what we're going to do today. And we bring in Stephen Trimble. Thanks for joining us once again, Stephen.
Well, as always, I'm delighted to be here, Tom. And I just think this is about the most important thing we could be talking about this year. You know, it all goes back to a conversation I had with two friends in 2000, which is now, 25 years ago. As the election between Bush v. Gore approached, my two buddies, who I respected immensely, basically said, it doesn't matter who wins. You know, they're just two white guys in suits. They're Washington politicians. It really doesn't matter. And I disagreed vehemently with that. And I still would, and I still do. I think it really does matter who we elect. And all of their appointments right down to the district manager for the BLM in Richfield will be different under a Biden scenario or a Trump scenario. And so in this election year, I was thinking, why don't we just talk about that? Because we've had a Biden presidency, we've had a Trump presidency, we know what they will do. So that's the origin of my idea. And I think that all of us can be thinking about this as the election approaches.
Well, yeah, I appreciate that idea, and I think this is a great idea for a program. So we bring in Scott Waldman, who's White House reporter for Politico's E&E News. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
We also are joined by Jerry Otero, Legislative and Policy Director for Grand Canyon Trust. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
And Luis Miranda, who's Acting Chapter Director for Utah Chapter of the Sierra Club. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Stephen, I don't know if you want to outline why we've invited these gentlemen on. We're going to get a Trump administration perspective, Biden administration perspective, and I guess a Utah perspective.
That's right. Yeah, I think it's just an enormously productive and interesting chance to talk about what each of those administrations might look like and what each of the campaigns are planning. And we're trying to be as nonpartisan as we can about this and just be objective. You know, what would the world look like if we elect President Trump again, or if we reelect President Biden? And so I think Scott has a lot to say about this. He's been reporting on the Trump administration and the Biden administration from Washington. So let's turn it over to Scott.
Okay, Scott. And I'd say, Scott, you're a former Utah resident.
That's right.
Yeah,
beautiful Moab, and I love the southwestern part of the state. It's just stunning. Southeastern too.
Yeah. So E&E News, what is E&E News?
So Energy Environment News, we just cover energy issues, obviously, and environmental issues, just through the lens of politics through Washington. We've got a number of reporters in Capitol Hill. I'm based out of the White House. We're part of Politico, and we sort of do dozens of stories every day just on these topics.
So you've been reporting on the 2025 project, I think is what the Trump campaign is calling this. So not only do we have a four-year history of the Trump administration, but the Trump campaign is outlining some very specific things they would do in a next administration.
So Project 2025 is actually, it's not a Trump campaign official document. It's a group of conservative organizations, more than 100 of them, and it's organized by the Heritage Foundation, which is one of the dominant conservative policy groups in D.C. since the Reagan years. And these are all staffed by former Trump administration officials. the groups that contributed to this document, as well as a number of former Trump officials who are expected to return in a possible second administration and probably have higher level jobs. These are people at the EPA, Interior, Commerce Department, Health and Human Services, just sort of throughout the federal government. And what they've done is it's a 900-page policy document. And clearly, these are ideas that are going to influence the next administration. They're written by former Trump officials, as I said, and they're written by people who are hoping to return to the administration, who are expected to actually implement these ideas. And it cuts a broad swath through energy policy. It's basically a 180 degrees from President Biden's energy policy. Just as one example, President Biden has a climate advisor, a man by the name of John Podesta. That position would be in a possible Trump second term. That would be replaced by an energy advisor whose job would be not to concern themselves with climate change and climate impacts in terms of policy, but actually sort of work as a liaison between the energy industry, the fossil fuel industry, and what it needs from the government, how the government can help expand oil and gas drilling, roll back whatever regulations it deems to be onerous or too costly, those kind of things.
Give me another few bullet points on what Project 2025 is outlining for the
Yeah,
environment.
sure. So it's very comprehensive. It's total reworking of the EPA, downsizing of employees. I should also point out two important things about its plans for the federal workforce. Number one is that they've been, along with this effort, they've been recruiting loyalists to Trump or the next conservative administration, as they refer to it. So they have been gathering resumes and conducting questionnaires and vetting people for more than a year. They won't say how many people they have, but you can certainly assume that it's in the hundreds, ready to come and implement this plan on day one. And they also have a plan called Schedule F that would create a new category of federal employee where, if you were deemed, a Biden loyalist, you could be switched into a Schedule F employee and then fired. It's hard to fire the federal career service for a reason. We don't want it to change. The government doesn't want it to change over with each administration. So this would really make it possible to totally make the government from the bottom up with a conservative workforce. But just to give you one example of how granular this is, USAID, which is our International Development Agency, they even have plans for that, where a lot of the work with USAID, of course, is providing relief and disaster relief, but it also helps, for instance, in regions of Africa, promote renewable energy. In a lot of the rural villages there, it's just not feasible to build a power plant anywhere near it. And so there's a lot of solar and clean energy expansion, since it's much easier to ramp that up and expand clean energy and give people in a lot of these villages electricity for the first time in their lives. Trump administration would completely, or Project 2025 proposes that the Trump administration would completely end all of those programs and instead encourage the use of fossil fuels, encourage companies to come and produce more fossil fuels in Africa, and sort of switch the country onto coal power and other sources that are domestic that they could ramp up. So it's fairly comprehensive and granular in what it proposes to do. Another proposal is to do away with the World Bank. The US would leave the World Bank, which again is a source for funding for a lot of clean energy projects overseas. And then we get to the EPA and the Interior Department, where anybody sort of working on anything climate related would be dismissed. A lot of offices shut down, including at the Department of Energy, the Department of, the Office of Renewable Energy would be closed. And a lot of the federal workforce, or a lot of the federal government's agencies and workforce would just be shifted towards how do you ramp up power production? How do you, switch to really what the fossil fuel industry wants? Let's look at any regulation that can be targeted. Let's go through the court system here and remove those agencies that are deemed problematic, or I should say, employees and offices within the agencies that are deemed problematic.
That's that's be very stark difference from the current administration. I
Oh,
mean,
yeah, like I
these
said,
are huge differences.
it's 180 degrees. And Trump, he's very proudly denies the reality of climate science. And he's sort of, he'll speak about it at rallies. He's been conspiratorial when it comes to renewable energy, for instance, suggesting that wind turbines cause cancer, which is absolutely not true. And also suggesting that, testing for wind turbines on the East Coast here in the Atlantic are causing whale deaths, which is also not true. Those whale deaths are almost always caused by boat strikes. So he's sort of bringing that. He also personally hates wind turbines because they're near his golf course in Scotland. So he's actually had this unusual fixation against wind turbines for going back decades. So he'll speak frequently, including at rallies, about how wind turbines slaughter eagles, which is of course true, but not talk about the cost of sort of dramatic increase of fossil fuel production, which, as we've seen from many oil leaks and disastrous ecological consequences over the years, has decimated wildlife, by the millions of individual animals and species. So yes, it's going to be very targeted effort to go after everything Biden's ever done on climate. And that's what Trump did the first term, but this time around, they're bringing in a team to make sure they're ready on day one. They're going to avoid the chaos of Trump's first few months in office, where they didn't expect to win and they were just staffing up all these agencies. Day one, they'll have all these people ready to go.
Stephen, I know you want to say something here.
Yeah, I'm imagining some of the listeners thinking, why does this matter to me? These are all big Washington organizations, long, 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 long ways from Utah. But think about how environmental regulation is really all about public health. In the valleys here in the Great Basin, in the Cache Valley and the Salt Lake Valley, pollution is such a big issue. I have friends moving away because they're concerned about the health of their children. Reno is the fastest warming city in America. And every summer, we all suffer from the waves of smoke coming in from wildfires all over the West and into Canada. So think about what this matters to you, in addition to your kind of gut reaction thinking, well, we could use less government regulation, but government regulation really matters to our lives.
Stephen, I want to have you follow up on something. You mentioned this earlier in the program, and Scott has been talking about this. Project 2025, my understanding of this, not only the environmental piece, but the whole scope of this, those who are writing this are concerned that the previous Trump administration was stymied by, people who were insufficiently on board with the programs that Trump was trying to implement. This time around, they're making very meticulous plans to, put people who are very loyal to this programming down to the very granular level. So I imagine this would include your local BLM office, for example.
Yeah, I think that's right. The Project 2025 people say what they're trying to do is institutionalize Trumpism and just make it a permanent part of American government. They say it's a battle plan, not a white paper. And just as Scott said, they're going to do it. We know that Trump went ahead and promised the Federalist Society that he would appoint conservative Supreme Court justices to reverse Roe v. Wade, and that's what he did. And Trump is certainly going to follow the lead of these many conservative organizations that are laying out a plan for him to absolutely change not just American government, but the way that we run our country, the way that we deal with each other. If we institutionalize Trumpism, we're institutionalizing taking revenge on your enemies and really reducing democracy in America. So it's a stark difference from what the Biden administration would continue to do.
Scott Waldman, I want to ask kind of the go opposite from what Stephen just did, the granular, go to the very broad, and talk about U.S. participation in international accords. President Trump, when he was president, famously took the U.S. out of the latest climate accord. I'm guessing, I don't know if there's anything in Project 2025 about international agreements on the climate.
There is, and that's a day one action that they would withdraw from the Paris Climate Agreement. It's a little tricky. You have to go through a process that takes months to officially withdraw, but you can expect that to happen. That process to start on the first day of Trump's presidency. There was actually some pushback against Trump the first time around, including from his daughter Ivanka. She did not want him to withdraw. She felt that it would, first of all, she wanted to do him to do more on climate policy, but also she felt that it would damage U.S. relationships overseas with a number of countries and that are key allies. And obviously, he did not follow the advice of his daughter, he ignored it. So we can expect them to be way more aggressive about pulling out of any international group that deals with climate. I mean, one Trump economic advisor I talked to recently, who had just come back from Mar-a-Lago a few days before, he's talking to Trump about withdrawing from the United Nations, of course, NATO, a lot of key international groups that would really isolate the U.S. further. Certainly, climate would just be one part of a multi-pronged effort to move away from any sort of relationship with countries when it comes to policy, not just energy, but also, with immigrants and any other thing you can imagine.
I'd like to bring in Jerry and Luis, just to, brief comments on. So Jerry Otero first, what you've been hearing about Project 2025 and a potential second Trump administration. Anything jump out to you from that?
I think what the unique situation we're in here as a country is that we've had the ability to actually see both administrations and their environmental and public lands policy, which we haven't had in modern times, the ability to see. We've been able to speculate and read documents. From the Grand Canyon Trust perspective, we don't engage in campaign work at all. So we're not really trying to look at what speculation may or may not happen. What we do know is that we've been able to work within the previous administration and the current administration. And as Scott noted, there's some very stark contrast between how those public lands would be managed. I'm calling in from sunny Grand Junction, Colorado, and you can see the differences in between how oil and gas is developed and leased, how we look at mining, how we look at pollution, how we look at climate. They're just completely different. And I would challenge our listeners and all of us here to think about what we're going to do. When we think about the terms climate change and carbon emissions, they can be polarizing because they've been politicized. I would say think about, if you think about water, think about drought, think about wildfire, and really think about the fact that those of us out west living in these communities, I'm a fourth generation Coloradan, the grandson of two miners out in the west. And so I understand the value of that work and understand the reason people are out west. But I would challenge us to think about what are we going to do? Because the trajectory that we're on and simply going back to an old model that has put us in a very tough position is not sustainable. And so we should think about the bipartisan solutions of what we can do to fix that. I think going back to massive leasings on a million acre scale that we've seen before is not sustainable. Simply going to high carbon emission production of power is not sustainable. Thinking and ignoring the challenges that we have with water are not sustainable. And those of us out west, whether you're in southern Utah, northern Arizona, New Mexico, western Colorado, where I'm at, you just have to understand the history. We have eyes, right? We go out and we understand these challenges and see the smoke from the wildfires, see the challenges that we have with water. And so these are issues that, whether it's a Republican administration, a Democratic administration, we have to work together, and simply drawing the contrast, the binary between the two, is a very tough situation, and arguably it puts all of us here in the West at risk. So we really look at a lot of the policies, and so I look forward to trying to work on these issues, but I think sometimes we polarize them as one or the other. Clearly, the Trump administration in its previous iteration, there were a number of policies that we disagreed with, but I would also argue there are things that the Biden administration could do better as well. And so we look forward to that opportunity in whichever administration it is to work with them.
Luis Miranda, I'd love to get your perspective on what we've heard from Project 2025. I know you're, as are all environmental groups, you're probably having to plan for one or the other, right? And it's going to be big differences between the two.
In our case, we have to really plan for both because we really don't know what the outcome of the next election will be. What I would say is, I think, Jerry, you're right, thinking about what is the trajectory we want to take. And I think often what we see in the national political landscape and in the public discourse is a lot of conversations around ideology and like simple talking points that, politicians from both aisles can deliver. But for us, like maybe a binary that I would invite listeners to think about is like ideology versus pragmatism, right? Some politicians can sometimes use their public platforms to sell particular ideas and are not really connected with what's happening on the ground. And there's other politicians that are more connected with trying to figure out what we want to do about given things. What I do think it's helpful about the Project 2025 by the Heritage Foundation is that at least it gives some institutionality or some view at systems and ideas of what's trying to be done so that we can have a conversation about what should happen in the future. And I think regardless of the administration, I think we should get as the public ideas of how each one of the future administrations plans to govern. I know that in the past when, you know, Trump has run for elections, we haven't always had necessarily like very clear plans laid out, but it's helpful at least to be able to have that conversation.
All right, we'll head toward a break here. Stephen Trimble, I think you'd like to say here before we head to a break, and then when we come back, we'll have Jerry Otero line out a kind of a scenario for a second Biden administration.
Well, I take us back to Earth Day. You know, when did Earth Day start? It started in 1970 after we had just national disasters that required passionate attention to change. You know, the book Silent Spring came out, Rachel Carson's book about the dangers of pesticides. The Cuyahoga River in Ohio caught fire from pollution. There was a massive oil spill off the California coast at Santa Barbara. And really, the people rose up with the agreement of elected politicians right up to President Nixon and said, take care of us, take care of our land, take care of our health. And that was the origin of the Environmental Protection Agency. And we've been celebrating Earth Day on this day every day since to pay attention to this world around us and ask each other, what can we do to protect it? What can we do to protect our relationship with nature? What can we do to protect our lives, which depend on this earth that we live on? And we're just looking at very different scenarios with each of these two potential presidents.
We are celebrating Earth Day, an Earth Day program we do every year with Stephen Trimble, our writer and photographer, author of Bargaining for Eden and many other books. And we're talking today as well with Scott Waldman, White House reporter for Politico's E&E News, Jerry Otero, Legislative and Policy Director for Grand Canyon Trust, and Luis Miranda, Acting Chapter Director of Utah Chapter of the Sierra Club. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. It's Earth Day, and as we always do on Earth Day, we bring in writer and photographer Stephen Trimble for an Earth Day program. Today, Stephen suggested we look ahead to the election and ramifications in case of a second Biden administration or a second Trump administration. And so we're doing that with Scott Waldman, White House reporter for Politico's E&E News, Jerry Otero, Legislative and Policy Director with the Grand Canyon Trust, and Luis Miranda, Acting Chapter Director with the Utah Chapter of the Sierra Club. Before we jump in with Jerry and outlining a Biden scenario, Stephen Trimble, I want to just, talk about Earth Day briefly with you. Depending on how it goes with the election, not only environment, but this is a hugely consequential election. A lot of folks are, stressed. At the very least, my liberal friends are stressed with the prospect of a second Biden, Trump administration. And bottom line, very consequential. So I want to spend just a minute or two on just Earth Day. What do you do for Earth Day? What do you suggest people do? Just take a break, celebrate the Earth.
It's an easy thing to do in Utah. You know, we can go out into public land so easily in the West. It's a little more difficult in the East to find yourself in big open spaces. But here in Utah, we never live very far away from wild country. You know, the urban wilderness that comes right down to our backyards along the Wasatch Front, the wide open spaces of the Great Basin, and the glorious Red Rock Country in southern Utah. You know, we have this enormous gift to relate to just an extraordinary landscape. And, I think that my guiding light when I think about interacting with the world is just pay attention. Pay attention. You know, we spend so much of our lives, you know, in a circle, day to day, doing all the things that we think we need to do without remembering to just look up to the mountains and think, oh my God, look at where I live. Or to take the chance on a weekend to go out to the Great Salt Lake or take a hike in surrounding trails, not very far at all from our homes. We just forget to do that. And Earth Day is a reminder to pay attention and glory in this remarkable landscape that we share.
Yeah, well said, well said. I just took a drive yesterday up Logan Canyon, just, 20 minutes, you're out in just some beautiful country. Let's turn to Jerry Otero, Legislative and Policy Director with Grand Canyon Trust. I know you've been looking at, you know, different scenarios, and I want to have you talk about some highlights of a second Biden administration. What are some things to think about in terms of what a 4 more years of Biden on the environment would do?
Well, there's a lot of speculation there. I wanted to first add a little bit of context to the conversation here, thinking where we're at in 2024. Oftentimes we look at the immediacy of an election or an administration. I would add that there's been a long trajectory here, an arc of work in the conservation community and stewardship that I think matters here, in that for so long, the stewardship led by indigenous communities, particularly in the West and really across the country, but in my world out here in the West, has been something that has been advocated for a very long time. Myself, my family and history have got deep roots in the West. I had the opportunity to grow up on a small plot of land, about 4 or 5 acres in rural Colorado. And really was that stewardship, that conservation, that way of life is really something that drove me to do this work. And I note that on a personal note, because understanding that wildlife was critical to where I live and why I live. And this is a story not just unique to me, but all of us here in the West and so many of us, that the wildlife, the populations of mule deer and fish and water and air are really is what defines us. And so the arc of what we're working on in conservation on a grand scale from the Grand Canyon Trust, from so many leaders out there, I think spans beyond administrations. And really the work is standing on the shoulders of so many others. And some of the work that the Biden administration has advocated for is only the result of so many communities and people standing up and advocating for clean air, clean water, making sure that this way of life that we have can be preserved, protected, and ensured that future generations can go out and enjoy those same things. You know, my grandfather started out, you know, hunting. That has been passed along to generations. How do we do that? You know, and oftentimes we think of partisan terms or politics to say how we define these things. But I think we can all agree that healthy populations of ungulates and plants and trees and forests are good for all of us, and we should work on that. I would also add that, we look at everything that a Biden administration has done, and I'll get to highlighting some of the policies here, but a little tongue-in-cheek, everything Scott said that the Trump administration would do, Biden, too, is really not that. It's such a stark contrast of what it is of saying EPA, Department of Energy, Department of Interior, the Bureau of Land Management, energy policy. It's a stark contrast, and we've had the opportunity to see that in the West. But that aside, talking a little bit of detail here about these spaces and what they mean and what those policies translate into. We think about oil and gas leasing as an example of it's either leasing or no leasing. And really there is a strategic place. And I think the administration, the current administration has approached that of saying, take a tailored and focused approach to that, to reduce carbon emissions, to get us in the right track. But I would also note for us on the ground that oil and gas leasing sometimes can be a technical component that many of us are getting involved in or commenting on. But we should also think about, as an example, if you look at Wyoming, a neighboring state here, they had a lot of oil and gas leasing. Their migration corridor, the Red Desert to Hoback corridor, which is the longest ungulate corridor in the lower 48 has been fragmented by oil and gas leasing, and they've lost, I believe, a third of their mule deer population because of this fragmentation. This is really well documented through the Wyoming Migration Initiative. I would encourage you all to take a look at that. It's got some really fascinating science. But the short of it is, the reason I'm making this point here is when we think about something like oil and gas leasing policy and say one leases, one is more strategic in their leasing, the impact isn't just we drill more and one we don't drill more on public lands. It's a connection to how does that leasing potentially impact communities with public health and their exposure to things that can be detrimental to their health. How does it impact the ground, the soil, and use of disturbing soil in terms of making roads and things like that? But also, how does it impact wildlife that then may have to go around an oil and gas site or something like that? And we've seen that happen in neighboring states. We want to make sure that when that development occurs, that it's occurring in a way that can make sure that we're preserving the way of life that we see in rural Utah, in rural Colorado, in all these special places that are connected to these iconic national parks, these iconic wilderness spaces. The health of these states and these national parks and these economies are directly tethered to the management of the BLM lands, to the management of U.S. Forest Service lands. And so those things that Scott noted, there is a direct contrast. And that's, I would challenge us again to think about, let's look beyond just the immediacy of the policy, but also the impacts that it has in these communities, in places where I live going up hunting and fishing. What does that mean for the next generation if the mule deer population or a sensitive species is reduced by a significant number? We're already seeing it on a grand scale. The loss of biodiversity, the loss of wildlife is dramatic. The loss of species is dramatic, and we have an opportunity here to reverse that, to chart a new course, and that's really where we're at as a country. I would just note a couple things here that we're seeing in the administration policy-wise, since I am the legend policy person at the Grand Canyon Trust. I would note here things like the BLM public lands rule, which was finalized last week, that really updates and modernizes BLM public lands management, has some good stuff in it, to make sure that we're preserving, protecting, that we are engaging communities, that we're working with indigenous communities. It's got a lot of things to really modernize BLM public lands management. Really, the action now after the implementation, or at least the finalization, let's talk about implementation, is the administration to act boldly, to ensure, to improve, to make sure that the land management bill lives up to the words on the paper, the rules, regulations, and how it really advances this work in terms of the timeliness of climate change. And that's really what we're looking at in a Biden and two administration. I would also note two other things here quickly. First, the old and mature growth forest work that's happening that now I believe is a National Forest Plan Amendment, the first of its kind to protect old and mature growth forests across the country. This is an effort that impacts almost all states that have old and mature growth forests that have slightly differing definitions. But the short of it is these are the oldest, most untouched forests in the country. These forests protect 10% or absorb 10% of the carbon emissions in our country. And so nature is a great technology, right? We don't necessarily have to create new technology to capture carbon emissions. We have old and mature growth forests to do that if we choose and can work forward to protecting them. There are places in this country where old and mature growth is gone. If you look at New England, all of their old and mature growth is gone. And so we're at risk of taking that away. This is also a challenge to us as a country to look at old and mature growth and understand that if these forests are gone, they're gone forever. There's no replanting them with new trees. There's no redoing what could be done. And so we're at this crossroads now of capturing carbon emissions, right? This is a great thing for our country, making sure we're preserving our heritage that is deeply tied to and embedded in these old and mature growth forests. And three, taking a real step to saying we can't undo what we've done if we choose to not protect these spaces. And so that's a process that's playing now within the federal government now, and we would anticipate in a Biden 2 that they would be working on that and maybe expanding that work. But those are two policies that have a direct impact on the West, particularly in Utah, that I think are of note. There's a whole other bunch of things here, right? I think the one, and Tom here, let me just make one last point here, is that a lot of the work will be centered on climate and carbon reduction, which we desperately need to reduce climate change impacts. And again, think of it in the terms of pollution, drought, wildfire. Those are all good things to mitigate those impacts.
Yeah, thanks for laying that out, Jerry. Stephen, let's go to you next.
I think Jerry's emphasis on climate is really crucial here, I think. You know, when we think of the whole approach to the environment these days, it's all connected to our future in terms of being able to live in our homes, so being able to live in our communities, being able to live on the planet. You know, the Trump administration's approach to all that is to dismiss it all as climate fanaticism and to unwind all the government programs that address science. You know, it really boils down to science. If you believe that the Earth is warming, we know that that's true because the scientists tell us that. It's not junk science, it's actual science. And if you believe that, then we must react. And the Biden administration, as we know, passed the biggest bill ever to address climate change, the Inflation Reduction Act. And I think a lot of people don't know that that weird name, the Inflation Reduction Act, of that piece of legislation really does all kinds of things to make life better for all of us. And we know that simply the Trump administration is going to reject all of that in favor of fossil fuel companies making more money. The whole approach to the world from the Trump people is not based on empathy. It's based on capitalism and profit, and will do nothing more than increase income inequality in America and the disparity between the very, very rich and all the rest of us.
Scott Waldman, anything you'd like to add on a Biden 2 administration?
Yeah, in terms of policy, I mean, when you're running for president, you're not going to be out there talking a lot about exactly what you want to do because that's vulnerable to political attacks. But I think what we can expect in Biden 2.0 is a new regulatory approach to CO2 emissions from some hard to decarbonize industries, including steel. And cement and things that we don't even think of as drivers of climate change, but they all have high CO2 production. So we're certainly going to see some new regulations, I think, on that industry, both incentivizing them by providing funding for decarbonization and the promotion of new technologies, and also as well as some regulatory approach to make that happen more quickly. Some colleagues and I have been doing some reporting. There's discussions within the White House about declaring a climate emergency. Biden may do that this summer ahead of the election, and maybe time it to some wildfires in a place like Utah, where, you know, just deadly wildfires has become an annual rite of passage as a result of climate change. So I think we'll see definitely some big moves from him, but whether or not it happens before the election is unclear. But, you know, they will be coming at this with a whole nother set of regulations. They've already ticked off the big items like vehicle emissions from cars and trucks, power plants, those kind of things. But there's a lot more, not more areas where they can go. And also, it just takes years for this stuff to really start working. So I think we can see that policies actually, you know, that Biden has already in place, they need some years to sort of put their roots down and also to avoid legal attacks that they're certainly would face in a second Trump term.
Thank you for that. Luis Miranda, anything you'd like to say briefly about Biden's second administration? Then we'll take a break, come back with you, Luis, on some Utah issues.
No, I agree. There will be a lot of continuations with the big plans of the Biden administration has in terms of transforming our, not just like our regulations, but also like our economy and the way that it can potentially transition into a full clean energy economy. And I think the Inflation Reduction Act is definitely one of those keystone pieces of legislation that are going to impact what happens as well here in Utah.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. We'll take a brief break. When we come back, we'll be talking with folks on Luis Miranda, the Sierra Club, and some specific Utah issues going forward, which will be greatly affected by this election. We're taking a look at this election year, a consequential election in many areas, including for the environment. And we're talking with Stephen Trimble, author of Bargaining for Eden and many other books. We're also talking with Scott Waldman, White House reporter for Politico's E&E News, Jerry Otero, legislative and policy director with Grand Canyon Trust, and Luis Miranda, acting chapter director with the Sierra Club. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're celebrating Earth Day, checking in once again, as we always do, with writer and photographer Stephen Trimble. And this year's theme is election year, very consequential election, including for the environment. Whether or not we have a second Biden administration or a second Trump administration, that's on the table, of course, in November. We're talking about this with Stephen Trimble, along with Scott Waldman, White House reporter for Politico's E&E News, Jerry Otero, legislative and policy director with the Grand Canyon Trust, and Luis Miranda, acting chapter director, the Utah chapter of Sierra Club. I want to turn to Luis Miranda and get perspective on the consequences in Utah of this election. Luis, you sent in a few things, and I don't know. I'm just bad on the environment, Luis. I'd forgotten about this. So we used to be doing weekly shows on Bear's Ears, but I guess it's kind of settled down. But yes, Bear's Ears, which, you know, was created, and then Mr. Trump was elected. He greatly reduced it. Mr. Biden expanded it again. I would expect, depending on which man is elected president, that would have an effect on Bear's Ears.
Absolutely. I think very simply put, I think with Biden, if Biden was to be elected, we will see opportunities for slow incremental change in climate policy, just because of the way that he's chosen to manage and the inclusivity that he's chosen to put into processes. And with Trump, we will likely see some degree of regression or maybe even dismantling of some of the very institutions like the Environmental Protection Agency, the Bureau of Land Management, and the U.S. Forest Service. And I think we can know this because we can look at the past to see what both Biden and Trump have done in their first administrations, which is a pretty unique moment in history. We can see that. As you were alluding to, Tom, you know, Trump was elected on November 2016. Obama in December 2016, created a proclamation that created the Bears Ears National Monument. Trump was inaugurated in January of 2017, and then, less than a year after it was created, Trump downsized Bears Ears National Monument by 85%, which is exceptional, unprecedented reduction of a national monument we've ever seen. So there was some kind of blowback. And then Biden becomes elected in 2020, starts, his mandate in 2021. Before the end of 2021, the monument was restored. And so currently where the Bears Ears National Monument is at is that it's in a process of public comments for its resource management plan. What the management plan does is essentially says, this is how we are going to run the national monument as the Bureau of Land Management and the U.S. Forest Service for the next 10, 20 years. It has a huge consequence, you know, over long term. If Trump gets elected, we are likely to see, again, something similar. Namely, we expect that there might be some downsizing of the monument, even potentially even an abolition of the monument. We see this at first, most likely impacting the new management plan that is being put forward. The current management plan that is in the public comment period is likely to have a final plan by the end of this year. It will likely be seen as illegitimate or just like not something that the Trump administration may want to run. We see the possibility of appointing a new Secretary of the Interior who might choose by internal policy to skip aspects of the enforcement that would not be favorable to folks that may, you know, support Donald Trump. And we're likely to see more pro-extractive uses of the land. You know, we've heard about possibilities for mining uranium east of the monument. We've seen, of course, local groups that continue to struggle against the White Mesa uranium mill from the Ute Mountain Ute community that is right in the borders of Bears Ears National Monument. Now, if Biden gets elected, we're likely to see more come into fruition from what Biden has started in his first administration. One of the things that is important to note is that there is the appointment of people like, you know, Secretary of the Interior Dev Holland, who is from the Laguna Pueblo, you know, tribe, or also the National Park Services Director Chuck Sam, who is Walla Walla and Cayuse from Oregon, who have been leading essentially a management approach that is inclusive from the get-go with tribal communities, but also of other impacted communities. What this means is that in practice, it just takes longer, right? And this is likely, can be sometimes difficult for the environmental community because we want changes and we need changes as soon as possible, but we might not always see it at that pace. And I think Bears Ears is just one aspect. I would name one other one here. It's just a cleaner act. It feels really, really important to note this. Right now, Utah happens to have two of the highest or dirtiest polluting like coal power plants in the West. Utah is also a energy creating you know, state that sells energy to other states. And a lot of it has been based on coal. And folks in coal communities have been wondering, like, hey, if coal is becoming so expensive, will these plants continue to run? Will I still have job? You know, will I still have an opportunity to provide for my family? And so there in the implementation of the Clean Air Act will come particular requirements that would likely need the installation of something called selective catalytic reduction systems that essentially kind of scrubbers of like the coal units. Those are really, really expensive to implement, which means that the cost of creating energy would go so high that some kind of transition would be necessary in order to be able to make costs work. Likely, if Trump gets elected, those aspects of the policy will likely not be implemented or enforced. We're likely to see changes, of course, in the EPA Region 8 office based out of Colorado that looks over decisions for Utah that will likely favor the continuation of more coal usage here in the state. Whereas if Biden was to continue, it's possible that, that we'll see this comes to fruition. The cross-state pollution rule is likely to continue to be fought in the courts, which means that something will need to be installed. There's regional haze decision that comes out later this year. And it means that for the Hunter and Huntington coal power plants, there's the other piece of legislation that Stephen was talking about, which is the Infrastructure Inflation Reduction Act, I'm sorry, the IRA, which is the largest climate investment in the history of the world. And it is meant to help energy communities like here in Utah to, you know, do things like transform the energy grid and also be able to put more solar turbines and solar, you know, solar panels, right, to be able to farm solar. And like Scott was alluding to it, it's not the most favored thing by the Trump administration, some of this clean energy components. So I think we are likely to see some showdowns, even if the Biden administration gets elected, reelected again. The state of Utah is looking to fight those federal enforcement efforts on the courts, which is likely going to draw out the conversation over what a transition may look like. So yeah, I think people in Utah will have a lot to suffer there.
A lot of issues there. Yeah, thanks about that. And apologies, Luis, I left you kind of a shorter segment there, but that's a great summation of what some of the top issues here in Utah. We just have a minute left. Stephen, I'll give you the last word here in the program.
I love having the last word, Tom. So as you're listening to all this, I encourage listeners to think about what can you do? And what you can do is vote. You know, this is an American democracy that we live in. And when you vote, think about what matters to you, the health of your children, your relationship with our landscape, the future of all of us in a land that is going to be battered by climate change. And remember that your vote is powerful, more powerful than the most extreme of our elected representatives. You know, the Colorado College State of the Rockies poll of Westerners every year finds out that there's huge support for acting on climate change, huge support for setting aside lands to preserve. You know, we want to preserve 30% of our land in some kind of natural state to preserve biodiversity, to fight climate change. All of that matters. All of that matters to each of us. And think about how your vote will determine how we address each of those things in the future. I can't think of any better way to support and celebrate Earth Day than to pay attention to our relationship with our land, the future of our children's relationship with that land, and what we can do to change the future with our vote. Happy Earth Day, everyone.
Happy Earth Day, everyone. Yes, Stephen Trimble has been with us. We've also been joined by Scott Waldman with E&E News, Jerry Otero with the Grand Canyon Trust, and Luis Miranda with Sierra Club. Gentlemen, thank you all for joining us on Earth Day.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thanks, everyone, for listening today to Access Utah.